Everyone, is everyone awake? The soup wasn't too heavy. I don't think we can stay awake for the hour. I wouldn't have been able to do this afternoon, I don't think, after the potluck. I don't know about the rest of you. Walking was already quite strenuous with the stomachs. Mike was all sprightly and we were like, oh, so much food up the mountains. So last night, we ended, let's say, the Old Testament. As you can remember, hopefully we were running through time from the beginning of days to, well, we won't make it to the end of days, but we just sang about the end of days, but we beginning of days till wherever we get tomorrow. And yesterday we kind of reached the moment when the last books of the Old Testament were written. And just to remind us what I said, I had a couple of conclusions that we may or may not have agreed with, but they were at least my conclusions. The one was, I said something along the lines of, in Judaism, a lot of people are saying, especially in ancient Judaism, messianism does not play as big a role as it does in Christianity. That many of the messianic prophecies before the exile actually seem to refer to King David and King David's house, but that messianism in Judaism actually starts to rise up during the exile when there is no longer a Davidic son on the throne and people know of the promises and they're looking at the throne is empty, they have this difficult word, cognitive dissonance, and they start to interpret those promises as prophecies and see a Messiah, and that it's not a very fixed idea of the Messiah. It's not just like it's going to be this man, he's going to have blonde hair and an awesome mustache and red shoes. No, they had kind of like, well, we don't really know what he's going to do. He might be a prophet, he might be a priest, he might be a king. It's a bit varied. So that's kind of where we were. And now today, this evening, I wanted to take us from the end of the Old Testament to King Herod, which hopefully we realize is the beginning of the New Testament with the birth of Jesus. And this is history that we know some of generally in the church because of some passages from Daniel, some of the prophecies, but a lot of this history we don't actually know a lot about generally in the church. And I'm assuming that this is general here as well, that not everyone knows all about the history. So we're going to be doing a bit of history to understand what happened in Israel between that time at the end of the Old Testament until Jesus' birth. What went on there and how did that influence what people were thinking about and how did that influence society into which Jesus was born? So these are basically the dates that we have that we need to, that we, just to put us in perspective. After the exile, even when they came back to Jerusalem, they built Jerusalem, but they were still under Persian rule. So they were not a free country. They were ruled by the Persians who were far away in Babylon. Up until the year 332, and all of these dates are before Christ, obviously, because we're talking before Christ. In the year 332, Alexander the great Greek king, he came by, and veni, vidi, vici, he saw, he won, he overcome, what, I can't remember what it is in English, and came, he saw, he... Came, I saw, I conquered. And he came, he saw, he conquered Israel, and then he moved on further to the east, all the way to far, far away. And this whole big kingdom became Greece. Well, this may remind you of one of the parts of the statue in Daniel. And up until the year 323, and the year 323 is the year that Alexander the Great died. He's a very young man. He died, and what happened is the kingdom splits into four. Why four? He had four generals. Each general got a bit. We generally speak about this in the prophecies as well. There was the one general, the big one, was the Seleucids, I think we say in English. The Seleucids, that was the general who got Israel and everything else to the east. And then you had the Ptolemaic kingdom, which was the king who got Egypt. And these are the two interesting ones for us. There were two others, I always forget their names. Cassandra. That does not sound like a male name. These other two kings, they are not interesting for our talk. So what basically happened was the Persian rule got swapped for a Greek rule, got swapped for the Seleucid rule, and nothing really changed for the Israelites. It was just, you know, a new person on the coin. But their life pretty much stayed the same. Except for when we get close to what we call the Maccabean Revolt. So when we get into the years of the low 200s and the high 100s, then things start to change in Jerusalem and tempers start to get a bit upset, and we see that revolts start to begin. And it culminates in something in 167, which we call the Maccabean Revolt, named after the man whose name's Maccabeus, Maccabean Revolt. And he eventually frees Israel from these foreign oppressors. So we have this period from about 200 to 140, where Israel is kind of semi-autonomous. So they can kind of say what they want, but not really. I don't know, maybe it's a little bit like Scotland, you know? You can kind of say what you want, but not really. I don't really know British politics too much, but I assume that May has something to say about here as well, unfortunately. So that's kind of what's going on here. They have some independence, but not a whole lot. And in this time, we have something which we call Hellenization. And Hellenization is just basically when you're ruled by a country, you start to resemble the country that rules you. So everyone started speaking Greek. Is that a problem? No, it's not. I mean, who cares what language you speak? That's not going to get you into heaven, right? Unless you don't speak Dutch, then you have problems. But what actually did help, problem was that the Jews themselves were discussing how far can we go with this Hellenization. And it's not a discussion that's strange for us because it's something that Adventists would have with how far can we go with the world. How far can we go and when do we draw the line? And the Jews were having the same discussion in Jerusalem at the time. If you wanted to count in Greece, in the Hellenic kingdom, you kind of need to have a Greek education. But if you have a Greek education, what happens to your Jewish education? Well, that kind of falls by the wayside. If you want your son to be able to do something in politics, you're going to have to send him to the gymnasium, which is the Greek education. But can we send our sons there? Shouldn't we send them to the local rabbi? Can we support Adventist education, or can we go to the Church of Scotland schools? Would be a contemporary example of how we do, how we think about this. And this discussion was going on in Jerusalem at the time. People were wondering, how far can we go with this Hellenizing process? And I suppose you could say you had liberals and conservatives. And conservatives were saying, no, 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 all of this Hellenism is bad. We don't want any of this. And then you had the liberals who said, oh, bring it on. Let's all become Greek. And we'll just be circumcised and then we're good to go. And then there was a large group in the middle who was neither hot nor cold. And they were more middle of the road for that example. And what was happening is around about the year 175, the high priest was named Jason. And high priest Jason, he was the first person, he was kind of pro-Hellenism, but not too much, and he built a gymnasium in Jerusalem. So a high school or school for the boys. In fact, he also created it so that the whole of Jerusalem was what the Greeks would call a polis, a city. We have the word politician from that, a person of the city. And that actually cost a whole lot of money because Jason had to spend a whole lot of money, send it to Antiochus Epiphanes, and Antiochus Epiphanes said, okay, well, here's your little document, and now you are a city, and Jerusalem was apparently very happy with this. At least some were, others weren't. In fact, some wanted to get rid of that whole polis bit, and other people said, no, 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 we need to become more Greek. We need to have baths and a theater and all of this. And then what happened was once they became a city, Antiochus actually offered anyone who did the gymnasium, which is kind of the high school, and the ephebete, which is the, let's say, post-grad. If you did both of those, Antiochus said, okay, you can be a Greek citizen. So he was pushing the young people, very smart, to become more and more Greek, to be less and less specific Jewish and more specifically Greek. And Jason, the high priest, actually renamed Jerusalem to the city to a different name, Antioch of Jerusalem, in honor of Antioch Epiphanes. But it got a bit complicated because besides Jason, there was another man who people really liked, and this man was named Menelaus. And Menelaus also wanted to be high priest. And Menelaus thought that Jason wasn't going too far enough. He was a very liberal. So he wanted to push them and push them so that we'd become totally Greek. And he was apparently a very smart man because he didn't try to arrange it internally, but he went to Antiochus Epiphanes and said, "Antiochus, old pal, if I give you, let's say, 500,000, will you make me high priest?" And Antiochus said, "Yeah, sure." Problem was Menelaus didn't actually have the money. So he went, once he became high priest, and took all the gold from the temple, gave it to Antiochus Epiphanes and said, "Here you go," and paid off his debt for becoming high priest with, let's say, stolen money, horribly stolen money. And it seems like some people were upset about this, as you can imagine. Now, if you think about the names we're talking about, Jason, Menelaus, these are Greek names, right? We hopefully know them from some Greek myths. They're not Jewish names. Jewish names would be like Joshua, but these are Greek names. And because of this riot going on in the temple, it got so bad that Antiochus Epiphanes actually had to come in and quiet things down. So he declared martial law. He sent in the soldiers, Greek Syrian soldiers. They came into Jerusalem in 167 and tried to calm things down. Generally, sending soldiers to a riot doesn't calm things down very much. It heats things up a bit more. They had another problem, and that was the fact that there's not a lot of place to put the soldiers. So Antiochus looked around and said, "Hey, there's a big building where no one's sleeping. They can sleep there." Sadly, it was the temple, which the Jews thought should not necessarily house soldiers, as you can imagine, especially because they were eating pigs, etc., etc. And then we have that time where history is a little bit ambiguous if this actually happened or not, but we often hear about it that they started sacrificing even pigs in the temple and the temple became impure. And this is all under the time when Menelaus was in charge. But it actually went much further, and that's where the real problems. The pig wasn't as much a problem as the fact that they outlawed circumcision, which you can imagine is a huge problem for Israelites. And they forbade them from observing the Torah. They only could keep the Greek laws. So the Jews were being incited in this time. They were losing their identity. There are a couple of responses. Menelaus, as we said, was all for it. We have another priest, Onias, and he said, "Okay, well, goodbye, guys," and he went somewhere else and built his own temple. We have a group of Essenes who went out into the desert and just started their own little sect. And then we have a man named Mattathias. And Mattathias, he was a priest from Jerusalem, but he didn't live in Jerusalem. He lived outside of Jerusalem, a city called Modin. And the legend is basically this, that one day a priest and a soldier came from Jerusalem into his village, and they said to everyone in the village, "You now have to sacrifice to the gods," not to the god, the god, but to the gods. And Mattathias heard this, and he didn't like it. And it was probably the final straw for him. And he got so enraged that he took the soldier's sword and he killed the priest and he killed the soldier. And thus a rebellion was born. He runs off into the hills, taking his seven sons with him. And this is the beginning of a big war, which we call the Maccabean Revolt. And we're going to stop history right here because we have a text written at this moment in time. So in a time when there's this big debate going on in Judaism, how Greek can we be? Where one of the priests have stood up and gathered a small army and is now physically attacking the Greeks. He's a freedom fighter or a rebel, depending on which side of the border you're on. And from that moment, we have a book. And the book is called, well, it's not, it's part of the book called First Enoch. Hopefully we all know Enoch, famous guy, walked with God. And there are five books that got joined together, and it got named First Enoch. Why? Because there's also a second Enoch and a third Enoch. And First Enoch verses chapters 80 to 83 is a part that which we call the dream visions. And basically what it is, it's just a retelling of history. So it starts at the very beginning, and it tells history all the way up to the Maccabean revolt. And then when it's done that, it starts talking about the Messiah. And it's very interesting because we can date this quite specifically, because the last historical event it gives is the Maccabean revolt. So clearly it must have been written just at the time, just after the Maccabean revolt. So this is how it looks, just to give you an idea. We have a couple of chapters that run from creation to flood. Then we have from Noah, which is obviously the flood, all the way up to the Exodus. Then we have some chapters which talk about the roaming in the desert all the way up to the founding of Judah, the country Judah, not going into the promised land. That's what I meant with Judah. Then we have some chapters about the judges all the way up to the first temple, which Solomon built. Then we have a discussion of all the kings all the way up to the destruction of the temple. Then we have a little bit about the exile. And then we have a discussion of the Maccabean revolt. And then right after that, that's the last historical thing they have. And after that, the book starts talking about Messianism. So it'll give us a good idea. So the first thing, here's a summary of it, and then we'll read a few verses in detail. What happens here when it starts talking about the Messiah is Messiah is something like this. A figure dressed in white opens the closed books of the Lord of Sheep. Opening the books, it's judgment, right? It's a common theme. He calls the seven heads of the white figures. As you can see, it's a bit complicated. It's like Daniel and Revelation. We don't really know what the seven figures or the white heads or whatever this is. But he calls the seven heads of the white figures and tells them to bring all living creatures. He tells one of the seven to bring him the seven shepherds. He judges the shepherds and the blind sheep. Now the sheep must be the people, right? Because they're being led by the shepherd. And the old house, which is probably Jerusalem, is taken to the south and a new house is erected. The remaining sheep worship the Lord. And there is a gathering, so the remaining sheep. So first the blind sheep, the Israelites, worship the Lord, but now we have a bigger group. The remaining sheep worship the Lord, and then there is a gathering in a new house, and the eyes have opened, and the house becomes great and full. So it's a bit strange, but we see that there's some kind of judgment going on here. This is not talking about any moment in time. This is talking about the moment when the Lord opens the books of judgment. And at that moment, then I saw a snow-white cow was born with huge horns, and all the beasts of the field and all the birds of the sky feared this snow-white cow and made petition to him all the time. And I went on seeing until all their kindred were transformed and became snow-white cows. The Lord of the sheep rejoiced over it and over all cows. Then I woke up and saw everything. And that's basically the end of the book. So this seems to be a Messiah figure here, but it's very, very hidden. It's not very clear. The snow-white cow, who everyone fears and who gathers everyone together, seems to be some kind of messianic shepherd, pastor. We have these all the beasts and all the birds of the sky, so not just the Israelites, but all the Gentiles seem to be joining together. And this is, strangely enough, one of the best examples we have of messianism in early Jewish writings, which is not great, is it? It's not very clear. Which is what I said, Judaism doesn't seem to be very busy with messianism, and this is the best that it has. Now, what is very important here, just that we notice it now, because we'll see that it changes, is that there's no description of war here, or fighting. The Messiah doesn't attack anyone, wage any war, kill anyone, go out and enrage people, none of that. So in a time of war, the Messiah seems to be peaceful. So moving on in time, we have the Maccabean Revolt. And the Maccabean Revolt is, let's see how much time do we have, is super, super complicated because everyone keeps dying, as you do in a war. So every year you have a new leader, right? And Mattathias, fortunately, has seven sons, so there's a lot of people who can take the torch once the oldest son dies. So Mattathias runs it, and then he dies, and then his son Judas takes it over, and he dies, and then his son Jonathan takes it over, then he dies, then Simon takes it over, then he dies. It kind of goes like that. I can give you all the dates, but I don't think anyone's very interested in that. What is very important is that in 167, this war starts. In 164, they're able to conquer Jerusalem. So by this time, Mattathias is dead, and it's his son Judas who has taken over, and Judas, Maccabee, conquers Jerusalem and frees, liberates Jerusalem from the Persian suppressors, oppressors, and they reconsecrate the temple. This is very important because up to this day, the Jews still celebrate that with Hanukkah, that is the bringing of the light to the temple. They still celebrate this one thing. Now, Judas takes it over, and then after a while he dies, and in 154, so 15 years later, his brother Jonathan takes over, and he becomes high priest. So Mattathias was just a priest, right? And we had Menelaus, who was paying Antiochus to be priest, but now we have someone who is high priest from their own people, someone who didn't sell out to the oppressors, a local boy. And Jonathan becomes priest, and then after a while, his brother Simon becomes priest, and after a while, Simon's last brother, John Hyrcanus, comes priest in 135. So now we are 32 years later. So we've got a whole succession of brothers being high priest. Because now we have something very, very strange, and that is because they're ruling Israel, or Jerusalem, they decided, well, you know what we actually need beside a priest is a king, right? Someone has to be king. And they look around and they say, you know who will make a good king? The priest. So the high priest becomes king as well. So John Hyrcanus, and this is in 35, is both high priest and king. And high priest has become a hereditary position because it's brother to brother to brother, and now it goes father to son. But we also have that the high priest is automatically a king. Now, traditionally, these are different jobs, right? Not something you'd expect them to be together. A priest and a king are different things. But here they've become same. And this goes on. Hyrcanus' son, Aristobulus the First, he also gets into power and he says, I'm king and I'm also high priest. So the jobs of king and high priest have merged into one. It's the same thing. It's one person on both the throne and, I don't know what a priest has, a pretty hat. Oh, one of these things, obviously. He's both the throne, he's got the throne and the priestly garments. Sorry? Breastplate, yes. And while this is going on, and this will kind of give us an idea, they've also been able to expand their influence. And what has happened is the dark green down at the bottom, that's what they had in 168. And then after a while, they're able to add the red and the brown, which look exactly the same here, so we'll do them together. And then in 104, they add the purple. Am I correct with 104? Yeah. So by 104, all of the purple has been added. So that's Judea and now Samaria has been added as well. And then all the way at the top where it says the green, that gets added in 103. And the green is Galilee. Now, why is Galilee important for Messianism, do you think? Because Jesus is going to be born there. But they weren't part of the Jewish kingdom until 62 years after the revolt. So it took 62 years after Jerusalem was freed until Galilee was added to this kingdom. And this is going to get very, very important when we get back to Jesus. Now we get some very interesting politics going on, because this king that takes us over as Aristobulus, he is very sick, so his wife kind of rules the kingdom, but then he passes away, and she wants to stay in power. Her name is Salome, and the way that she stays in power is she finds his favorite son, brother, who's the heir to the throne, and says, "Do you want to marry me?" He says no, so she kills him and goes to the next one, and he said wisely yes, because he knew what was happening. So she married the second brother, and the other brothers ended up in prison and died. So she stays in power with her new husband. Fortunately, he's a bit more healthy. He rules for 27 years in the year 76. So we're getting close to Jesus now. In the year 76, he dies. And Salome says, "Well, you know what? I'll be queen." So she crowns herself queen of Israel. But she can't be high priest. I mean, that's just pushing it too much for the Israelites. So she gets her son, Hyrcanus, to become the high priest. So from the story, you can get the feeling that this ruling class is becoming a bit corrupt, right? These are not men and women of God who are ruling Israel. You can imagine some people had some ethical questions about the nature of the queen. And it gets even worse after that. Because after a while, Salome, she can't live forever, she dies. And it becomes a discussion, well, who's going to be the new king? They didn't stay with the queen, they went to kings. And what happens is they've got, on the one side, the guy who already is the high priest, Hyrcanus, and they've got Aristobulus, the other son, who's also wants to be high priest. And they don't know how to sort this. They obviously don't have democratic elections, which seem not to work anyway. So, I mean, why do we bother? Was that too sarcastic? Sorry. Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, they're brothers, and they both want to be high priest. And they think, you know what I can do is, why don't I go talk to the Romans? So both independently, without the other knowing, go to the Romans and ask the Romans to come conquer Israel and make them high priest, which seems to me like throwing out the baby with the bathwater. But they both go, and obviously they both offer Rome a lot of money, like their great-great-great-great-grandfathers did back then. And they talk to General Pompey, and they both say, well, we'll give you a whole lot of money if you make us high priest and king. So Pompey listens to both, and the Romans are nothing but ruthless, and thinks, okay, he makes a deal with both of them. Goes to Jerusalem and attacks Jerusalem, but no one defends Jerusalem because both parties are waiting for Pompey to come in and make their leader king. But each doesn't know that the other one's done this. So it's a bit of intrigue going on. And Pompey comes in, and apparently Hyrcanus paid the most. So he makes Hyrcanus not king, but high priest, against the deal. And the other brother, who was the current high priest, he gets sent to Rome, put in a prison, and doesn't live very, very long. So we have Hyrcanus as high priest and Aristobulus as ex-high priest. And then Pompey installs his own king, Herodias Antipater, or sometimes we call him Herodias Antipas. I don't know what's more common in English. Antipas? So, it says Pater, but let's all remember Pas then. So Herodias Antipas they put as a puppet king. The problem with Herodias is, or Herod the Elder, is that he's an Arab. And the Jews don't really want to be ruled by an Arab, for very obvious reasons. So things get a bit complicated then, because both Hyrcanus and Aristobulus have children. The one's name's Alexandra, a woman. The other name's Alexander, a man. And they have a daughter together. These two cousins get married, have a daughter named Mariamne. And Herod's son, Herod, very original, sees Mariamne and thinks, well, that's a good idea, and marries her. and makes, well, because Mariamne begs him, makes her brother high priest. So Herod, trying to cement his claim to the throne, marries Mariamne as his second wife. And you can see maybe their second wife of 10. So the man was not into long-time commitments. Because he marries her, cements his throne, and then does this. Kills everyone. He kills Hyrcanus, the old high priest. He kills Mariamne's father, Alexander. He kills Mariamne. He kills Mariamne's brother. And then he kills all of his children that he had together with Mariamne as well. Just gets rid of all of them. Just cleans the slate because he's worried because they have a more legitimate claim to his throne. This puts maybe the murdering of the babies that Herod did into a bit of perspective, right? It totally fits his character. This was then his second wife that he killed, and he managed to kill another 8 or so throughout his career. And now we can pause time again. I know this is a bit gruesome, but it's very gruesome for a reason. I'm telling you this all in detail for a reason, because it kind of gives us an idea of how the Israelites would have felt about their priests and kings. I would not want these people to rule me. Neither would any of us, right? These are not the people who the Lord has called to raise up the booth of David. This can't be it. So we have this cognitive dissonance. We know that God has promised to David, your house will rule, but this can't be David's house. This can't be what God meant. This can't be the Messiah that we've been waiting for all through the exile. This can't be it. These people can't be God's. So it has to be something else. And right at this moment, halfway through, 30 BCE, we have another book, a Jewish book called the Psalms of Solomon. They weren't written by Solomon, but they were called the Psalms of Solomon for some reason. And these Psalms are kind of a political manifesto. They are looking at the leaders of Israel, and they're saying, well, I don't know what's up with that, but I don't trust them. And there's about 20 of these psalms, and I want to read one of them with you, or at least a part of them. This is the 17th one. Lord, you chose David to be king over Israel, and swore to him about his descendants forever, that his kingdom should not fail before you. But because of our sins, sinners rose up against us. They set upon us and drove us out. So this is talking about the people who conquered the Israel. Those to whom you did not make the promise, i.e. the Gentiles, they took away from us by force, and they did not glorify your honorable name. So this is talking about the exile, it seems. And then we skip a few verses and he continues, as the enemy was a stranger and his heart alien to our God, he acted arrogantly. So he did in Jerusalem all the things that the Gentiles do to their gods in their cities. That Hellenism that we were just talking about. And the children of the covenant living among the Gentile rabble adopted these practices. No one among them in Jerusalem acted with mercy or truth. So we first had the critique of the exile, and now it seems to be talking about this process of Hellenism that went on. And then these people that are ruling it, well, they're clearly not great. And then we get the Messianism. See, Lord, raise up for them their king, the son of David, to rule over your servant Israel in the time known to you, O God. Undergird them with the strength to destroy the unrighteous rulers. Well, he's no longer there, but he was there a minute ago. Herod, the unrighteous rulers. To purge Jerusalem from Gentiles and Arab running our country. To trample her to destruction in wisdom and in righteousness. To drive out the sinners from the inheritance. So rising up a king, this is clearly this messianism. But it's different to what we just read in Enoch. There's no judgment going on, but it's war, right? It's fighting. It's drive him out, trample them. It's become a violent, a warlike Messiah here, just before Jesus was born. 30, not even, when was this written? About 30, so 25, 26 years before Jesus was born, one generation. This is how people are looking at what's going on there. They have this ruler put there, but he's a terrible, terrible person. And this whole family is a terrible, terrible people because they're all killing each other, trying to get into power. And that's not how Davidic kingship should work. They're fallen. And based on this, we see that the Messianism gets stronger and stronger. At the same time, roundabout, these are harder to date, we have a collection of books called the Dead Sea Scrolls, which give us quite a unique witness to the same time. And we see a lot of Messianism in there. I still have 15 minutes. I haven't been going that long. It's been about half an hour. I will tell you some things about the Dead Sea Scrolls. I don't know if everyone knows this, but it's good to know some information about this. I'm getting hot. I should have listened to you. They said I don't have to talk with my jacket. It's quite fun. The Dead Sea Scrolls are probably the biggest find for biblical studies in ages because we found a whole lot of documents that we know for certain were written at a certain time and they were hidden for a long time. So there are no mistakes in them from people copying it, etc., etc. Now, how they were found is a fun story because there's actually two stories about it. And I use the word very carefully here, two myths about it, and I think they both are myths. They both are in the same story. The one story is in the winter of 1946. There are three Bedouins, and they're staying in the desert around the Dead Sea. And they're all three shepherds, and they're sitting around the campfire. It's been a long day, and they decide to have a stone-throwing competition. And where they look far away, there's a whole lot of caves, and they play a game, who can throw the stone into the cave, the one they pointed. So they're like, oh, the third one from the left. And they're throwing, and suddenly one of the men named, well, I'm going to have to say this, Muhammad Khalil, he hears something breaking in one of the caves that they throw it into. Smart as he is, he doesn't tell anyone. They continue their competition. Fortunately, history won't tell us who won this competition. But when Juma gets back home, he tells his cousin, also named Muhammad the Wolf, El-Dib. He tells him what he's heard, and this Mr. the Wolf goes to the cave, and he's looking for hidden treasure and gold. Sadly, all he finds are these kind of clay pots, and in these clay pots are some kind of animal skins with weird little symbols on them. The man could not read. Another story about how these were found is very similar. There was like a shepherd, just like in the Gospels, he has 100 sheep and he's lost one. He's looking everywhere, and finally he gets into the cave. He finds the lost sheep, and next to the sheep he sees some jars. Inside are animal skins with weird drawings on them. But they don't know what they are. And they take one home and they sell it to a Westerner. And the Westerner gives them a lot of money for it. So quickly, running back to the cave, they get all the other skins and they sell them to these Westerners. And the whole clan gives up sheep farming and goes to these caves to try to find more and more of these pots. And soon they discover two things, and this is very, very sad to say. They discover that they get the most money for a piece that isn't too small, but they don't get a lot more money for a big piece. Tradesmen as they are, they set about making many, many small, reasonably sized pieces. So, big piece, if we tear it up into little bits, we'll get much more money. You can imagine that a million archaeologists cry when I just even think about saying that. And they also discover for very small pieces, they don't get any money at all. So those they all just throw aside. And a million more archaeologists cry with that as well. Now what they found were a couple of these kind of things, which are complete scrolls. The height of that is about this high. This is Isaiah. You can see the writing's very small. Well, you can't see the writing, so it's very small. In the end, after about 11 years, they found a total of 11 caves with these pots in them. And we have about 9 complete scrolls like this. And we have, and this is the horrible part, we have 50,000 fragments. And these fragments look like this. So I can't say they're about the size of a postage stamp because they're much smaller. And the best way to imagine this is imagine you like to collect puzzles. There must be someone there. And you have about 900 puzzles. And each puzzle has about 1,000 pieces. And then the first thing you do is you throw away all the edge pieces of the puzzles. So now you've only got the inside of these puzzles, right? And then you randomly throw away some parts. You just grab in and throw away handfuls of these puzzles. Some of them you throw all of them away except for a couple. Some of them you only throw a few of them. So now you have 900 puzzles, no edges, and none of them are complete. And then what you do is you take them all, you dump them in the bath, shake them around, and then try to put the puzzles back together. 9,000 of those pieces. We've been trying to put them together since 1964. It's not going great. As you can see, they also don't look very different to each other. They're all brown and they all kind of look the same. So it's very, very hard to put them together. But scholars are working day and night with tweezers and gloves to put these things together. And we've actually put together quite a lot of these scrolls, amazingly enough. If you go onto YouTube and you look up Dead Sea Scrolls conspiracy theory, you'll hear a lot of reasons, other reasons why we haven't published them. Mainly it's the Catholic Church because it undermines Christianity. This is all insane. The reason is it's very hard to put together a puzzle like this, and it's just taking a long, long time. So we have all of these puzzles, all these pieces, and we don't really know why they're in the caves. Some people think that maybe there was a monastery nearby and this was the monastery's library. Some people say maybe it's the Library of Jerusalem that they hid there. Some people say, well, maybe it's just people who put some stuff in caves. We don't really know, but we have a whole lot of these scrolls. And all of these scrolls are definitely written before the year 80. So they're very, very old and very, very easy to date. And the scrolls are, as you can see, even the best ones, we're missing bits of them. And you can imagine the ones that are put together as puzzle pieces are missing more of them. So it's not always easy to read them. And when we do, we find some gaps in the text. But what we've put together is found some very interesting and shows us very good information about ancient Judaism. And I was going to read for our last 10 minutes a couple of those texts to show us some more messianism from there. One of the things we found was this, and this is a part of a commentary on Genesis. So these Jews took Genesis and they wrote a commentary on it, gave you some more information. And we read this in Genesis yesterday, and this is their commentary. The scepter shall not, where you see those square brackets, there's a bit missing there, there's a hole in the text, but we think it says knocked, because that makes sense. The scepter shall not depart from the tribe of Judah, while Israel has the dominion. There will not be cut off someone who sits on the throne of David, for the staff is the covenant of royalty, and the thousands of Israel are the standards. Until the Messiah of righteousness comes, the branch of David, for to him and to his descendants has been given the covenant of the kingship of his people for everlasting generations, which he observed, there's a bit missing there, the law with the men of the community for, but missing again, it is the assembly of men of, whatever that assembly is of, is a mystery. But this is the first time that the branch of David is called the Messiah. That those two words are used together. Because this predates the New Testament. So here we have a text written by Jews who associate the words, the branch of David, which we associate with Jesus, with the word Messiah, which we associate with Jesus. So here we see that messianism seems to be developing into something that much more resembles what we would think is messianism, that the Messiah and the branch of David have come together as one. We also have a commentary on Numbers. Well, this is not technical commentary, but it's like a commentary. I'll tell you more about it. There it says, and the star, so it's talking about the star and the scepter of Numbers with Balaam, and the star is the interpreter of the law who will come to Damascus as is written, Numbers 24, a star comes out of Jacob and a scepter arises out of Israel. The scepter is the prince of the whole congregation, and when he rises, he will destroy all the sons of Seth. This is from something called the Damascus Document. It's kind of like the church manual, but then for them back then. And here we have something very interesting, because we see The scepter is the prince, and when he rises, he will destroy the sons of Seth. So that seems like a normal kingly messianism. But at the top, we have this, the interpreter of the law, which is someone that they're expecting, but we haven't run into that yet. We didn't read that anywhere in the Old Testament. And you may think, well, Tom is just reading something more. We see him all over the place. This is from elsewhere in the same document. And God appraised their deeds because they sought him with an undivided heart and raised up for them a teacher of righteousness in order to direct them in the path of his heart. So this seems to be some kind of specific figure that these people are looking for or looking at. And the document doesn't say a lot about this man's life or ministry, but it does say something about his end. He says, "Thus all the men who entered the new covenant in the land of Damascus and turned and betrayed and departed from the well of living waters shall not be counted in the assembly of the people. They shall not be inscribed in the list from the day of the gathering in." So some people are not being included. Until there arises the Messiah out of Aaron and Israel. So there's some kind of unique teacher, and he is there at the same time as the Messiah out of Aaron and Israel. Well, a Messiah out of Israel makes sense to us because that's a king, but a Messiah of Aaron, that then must be a priest. So we have a Messiah who's both king and priest here, and we have this teacher. And the day of the gathering in of the unique teacher, so the day the unique teacher dies, until the end of the men of war who turn back from the man of lies, there shall be 40 years. So when the teacher dies, it'll be 40 years until the end. So this teacher has some kind of something to do with the end of times. So, and we don't really know what's up with this teacher. But if we read the New Testament well, and we think about John 3 and 4, we see something similar that has always intrigued us a little bit. And the two passages I'm talking about is the one about Nicodemus and about the woman at the well. And did I bring my Bible? That might be handy. Both of those seem, and that's always been a little bit strange until we found these passages, they seem to be talking about some kind of teacher. It's in John 3, verse 2. I'll read one as first as well. "Now there was a Pharisee named Nicodemus, the leader of the Jews. He came to Jesus by night and said to him, 'Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher who has come from God.'" Now, we could read this just as very simply, "Oh, he's a teacher who came from God." But this has always been a bit intriguing because what teacher comes from God? And we run into it again with the Samaritan woman. I'll just find the verse for you. Can't find it now. That's unfortunate. Jesus said, it's chapter 4 and it's somewhere in the 20s. Let me just, the story is that she's coming and there's this discussion about where should we worship? Should we worship and Jesus says we should worship in spirit and in truth and not in a place. And then she's talking about some kind of teaching, and then she talks about the Messiah that is coming, who is called Christ, and when he comes, he will proclaim all things to us. And there seems to be this expectation of some kind of teachings there as well. 25? Right, God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. The woman said to him, "I know that the Messiah is coming, who is called Christ. When he comes, he will proclaim all things to us." Jesus said to her, "I am he, the one who is speaking to you." So here the Messiah seems to be associated with unique teachings, which is something we didn't read anywhere in the Old Testament, but we do read here with this interpreter of the law, the teacher of righteousness. So there seems to be that the Jews started to expect also that the Messiah was associated with unique teachings, which makes a lot of sense for us from the New Testament perspective, because Jesus brought many, many new teachings, which people seem to accept well, the people seemed to accept quite readily, the Pharisees and etc. didn't. And the other thing that we see then in the Dead Sea Scrolls is that these, what we saw earlier, the two messiahs really come back. Is that here? Yes. I can't read it here. Only the sons of Aaron will have authority in the matter of judgment and of goods, and their word will settle the lot of all provision for the men of the community and the goods of the men of holiness who walk in perfection. They should not depart from any counsel of the law to walk in order to walk in complete stubbornness of their heart, but instead they shall be ruled by the first directives which the men of the community began to be taught until the prophet comes. The prophet comes, and the messiahs of Aaron and Israel. So here we see, earlier we saw Messiah of Aaron and Israel together. Here we see them separate. And what we discussed was we're seeing in the civil authorities that Aaron and Israel, the priest and the king, are starting to be joined. And it seems like that joining that they're seeing happening in Jerusalem seems to be happening in the Messianism in some way as well. So we ran through between the testaments, and we could draw some conclusions. There seems to be more of a rise of Messianism now. It started very, very slowly in the beginning, and it picked up a bit in exile when people started to get a bit more upset about what would happen to the kingdom. And now when they see that they have their kingdom back, but the rulers are terrible, terrible people, it seems to be rising more and more and more. And there seems to be a strong reaction to how they see the rulers and priests having fallen as in doing terrible things. We also see that civilly the positions of king and priest have merged, and that is starting to reflect in the Messianism, that these two are almost joining maybe in some places, but we still see this huge variety in expectations. So there isn't this one Messiah figure who's going to do this, this, and this. Sometimes he wages war, other times he doesn't. Sometimes he's part of the gathering, in gathering of all people, other times he's not. Sometimes he's part of the judgment, other times he's not. Sometimes he's a priest, sometimes he's a king, sometimes he's a king and priest, sometimes he's a teacher. So there's all this variation going on. That shouldn't come as a big shock to us, because if we think about the New Testament, there's a whole lot of variation as well. Right? They say, Jesus, you are the king. We want to crown you king. Other places they say, Jesus, we are waiting for the consolation of Israel. Other peoples, they say, we're waiting for the redemption of Israel. Well, consolation, redemption, those things sound much more religious. When they say, are you the king of the Jews? Jesus says, I am. And they take it to be, you are part of God, in that discussion with Pilate. So there's all these different expectations going on. And it seems like Jesus fits into many of these boxes. So we see great variety and not much uniformity. It's not quite simple what they are expecting. And also we have to say we don't see a whole lot of it, because I showed you most of it today. We have a lot of texts written between the two testaments. We have about 40, 50 books. I was able to show you two books and a couple of the Dead Sea Scrolls. We have about 200 Dead Sea Scrolls, and I showed you three. So if we have a pile this high, we use this much of the books to find Messianism, and the rest don't really discuss it. So it seems like, just as we said yesterday, Messianism is very much a minor part of Judaism. It's a big part of Christianity, should be a big part of Christianity, but Judaism was much more busy with things like the Torah, rather than busy with the one who is coming. So I think that's what I wanted to share tonight. It's 8:00. We've been listening for a while. Do you want to take it away, or shall we just go for it for questions? Does no one have a question? Then we all can go home.
I think with the questions, please raise your hand and wait till the microphone is with you, okay? Secondly, don't touch the microphone. Marcel will hold it for you. Then he'll have it the right distance from your mouth, okay? So, we're ready for questions. Marcel, is Dorothy here?
Thank Thank you. Thank you very much. That was absolutely fascinating. I hadn't really gone in much to the intertestament history, and that was absolutely fascinating. I'm curious, the history there, we understood that the Romans had conquered Israel, but obviously they asked the Romans to help them, from what you've just been saying, which was very interesting. What would be the population of Israel about this time? I mean, from the map you showed us, they spread quite widely. Were the Romans not interested in what they were doing? Did they allow them to do this? And then when they were invited, when Herod was invited to come and be their king, as you said,
mm-hmm.
then the Roman influence began to take place. Was it not there before this?
No, so before then it was mainly part of the Seleucid kingdom, and what was happening was there was a change of power going on. The Greeks were losing power and the Romans were gaining power. And the first century before Christ was the time when Rome was really starting to expand. But they hadn't expanded. We think of the Roman kingdom all the way up to Britain, but when did they make it to Britain? I'm looking at the British here, somewhere in the first century. It took them a while. They made it to Gaul. Caesar fought in Gaul. That was in the first century. So the Roman expansion took place a bit later than the biblical times.
So what would be the population of, we call it Israel, what would it have been at this time, the actual population?
Very hard to say. When we just look at Jerusalem, you'll hear numbers between 10,000, so a little bit bigger than Crieff, all the way up to 500,000, which seems a bit unrealistic to me for a city without running water. But 10,000 seems very small, but it's very hard. And the big problem that we have specifically with Jerusalem is we are not allowed to do any archaeology there, really, because it's all holy. So it's very hard to look back in time and try to discover these things. With other cities, you can see how many houses there were and start to guess. But the numbers would have been quite low.
Yeah.
And in Galilee, it was mainly little villages, small little villages. Each village had maybe 100 people, if you're lucky, living there. A big market town might have 300. So the whole of Galilee, you're talking closer to thousands than tens of thousands, strangely enough.
But it's quite fascinating that the teachings of God had survived those intertestament times.
Right.
And they were still having the sacrifices, the services, albeit corrupted perhaps,
mm-hmm.
but it had survived, which tells us a lot about the hand of God over the mess that was here, doesn't
it? Yeah, so when they got back, remember the cupbearer came back to Jerusalem, got the temple going, they seemed to... We call this the Second Temple period, and that seemed to be going quite well, but it was very localized. It was no longer the big kingdom of Israel and Judea. So up in Galilee, and I was going to talk about this tomorrow, but I'll give you a few hints. Up in Galilee, the people living there were not Jews, because those were part of the northern kingdom who had fallen hundreds and hundreds of years ago, and no one had moved back there. When the Israelites moved back from Babylon, they didn't move up to the north. They moved into Jerusalem predominantly. So they were mainly focused in that little green, the lower green bit. Jericho and Jerusalem and not much more around that. That's where the Jews seem to have predominantly lived. And all around them were other peoples, Syrians and Greeks and Persians and Assyrians, which are not Syrians, but something else, and Phoenicians. You had all these people, different groups living around them. So at this time, Judaism was very small. It was very, very minor. It didn't actually play a role, and Rome wasn't really interested in conquering Jerusalem. It was just that it was given to them for free, that they took it. Otherwise, they probably wouldn't have bothered for a long, long time, because it wasn't Egypt. Turkey, small Asia, and Asia Minor. This is very inconspicuous, inconsequential for world history. For us, it seems very, very important. Theologically, it is, but politically at the time, no one really cared about Jerusalem too much.
I think it might be worth pointing out, if I may, from what I've observed, even though Israel was tiny and insignificant Jerusalem was very, very small, there was still a lot of work being done by the Jewish scholars in that intertestamental period. I haven't got the names and the dates in my head, but what we would call interpretations and commentaries being written. So there was a lot of research being done, mostly on the previous writings. What was meant by statements in the Torah? How do we interpret this for the then today?
Yeah.
And what, of course, is interesting from that is, as you rightly say, the Messianism is a very, very small part of that.
Yeah.
But kind of related to what Dorothy was asking about, that there was a core growth continuance going on in those years.
And this is very much the time when we speak of the diaspora, so the Jews spread throughout the world. So you will have pockets of significant Jewish influence in many, many places. So Alexandria, there were thousands of Jews living there. That's actually the place where we have the first pogrom, with anti-Semitism, and the Jews happened in Alexandria in the first century BCE. Up in Babylon would have a whole lot. In Turkey would have had a whole lot of Jews living in certain market towns there. And they were not only the Jerusalemites, but all the Jews were producing a lot of research and a lot of writing because they're people of the book. And we have, we have a lot. This was maybe a bit over-exaggerated, but if we put the books, we'd probably have it this high, which is quite a lot because we don't have that many Christian writings from the first century this high. So they produced a lot of writings, and we lost most of them, but we still have quite a few, mainly thanks to the Dead Sea Scrolls. So they may have been politically unimportant, Jerusalem, but as a people, they were everywhere, and they probably were very well known.
Moving through the intertestamentary times, and you come to the time of Christ, the wise men, the Magi, they come to Herod.
Yeah.
Where is the star? We've seen the star, the king of the Jews. What had they been studying? They knew of something.
Oh, right. Yes, yeah, so they came from the east, and we take that as a reference to Babylon. Babylon at the time was a big place of learning. It was the capital of the Persian Empire.
What I'm trying to say is, I didn't mean to stop you. There is some messianic expectation there. A king of the Jews.
Right. So, yes. Stars are very closely associated for all these cultures with kingship. For many cultures, if a king dies, he becomes a star, and you would see a star at birth. I don't know if we need to say that the fact that they saw the star came from specific Jewish messianic prophecies, but might have been, because it's a common theme also in Persian thinking or Egyptian thinking, that the birth of a king or who is actually a god is associated with something occurring in the heavens. So a star or an eclipse or some kind of alignment of the stars. So if they saw this, they may have. And these people were, and that's Babylon was very big in that, was very big in looking at the stars, astrology, right? They were the people who counted to 12, and that's why we have 12 signs in the zodiac and all of that. That's all comes from Babylon. So they were people who looked at the stars a lot. So if they saw a strange star, they probably would have quite quickly associated that with a king. I don't think it would have necessarily had to have come from reading a passage from the Old Testament. It may have, because there were a lot of Jews in Babylon, but it may also have just
been
a general.
They came inquiring of the king of the Jews, didn't they?
Right, because they see the star above Jerusalem or above Israel. So they're following the star, they come to the country, and they're like, well, there's the star, there has to be a king born. We in Jew land, to use the word with all respect, so we need a king of the Jews. That might be the way that happened. If they had ended up in Egypt, they would have said to the Egyptians, where's the king of the Egyptians? Just because obviously the king is born in his own country. or they read Numbers 24 and took that as a prophecy. It's just that we don't see a whole lot of that. We see it as a very minor part of Judaism at the time. So why would these people who don't know Judaism very well be very well associated with a minor part of Judaism? You know, like people who know Adventists, what do they know? They know the Sabbath, they know we don't eat pork. They probably don't know a whole lot about the intricacies of the heavenly ministry of Christ. Right? That would be one of the later things they learned. So either these people are very learned, or there are multiple reasons, just possibilities. It doesn't have to be one or the other.
My traditional hat would say that the Lord had kept alive an expectation of a Messiah. Mm-hmm. But that might be me speaking as a Christian Adventist this side of the...
And it could be, and the Lord leads us and the world and life and from something that was very minor, right? This small promise became this huge messianic variety. Why couldn't the Lord have led that? It's just, I don't think that the average Jew woke up every day and looked around to see if the Messiah had arrived yet. That's what I was trying to get to. I think that's why I'm emphasizing that it was more of a mind. They were more worried about how am I gonna wash my hands in the desert to be pure than has the Messiah come yet, because it's 12:30 already. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's kind of more what I was saying. I'm sure that there were many, because we read throughout the New Testament, all these people who are waiting for the Messiah. In Luke 2, we have two in a row. The prophet Anna and, I'm terrible with names, Simeon, yes. Right? And they're both waiting for this Messiah. And they're both in the temple at the same day. Well, that's quite a coincidence. Probably there were a lot of people waiting for the Messiah, but it was less predominant than other bits of Judaism. That's...
Just picking up on the Babylon issue, it's possibly worth pointing out that not all the Jews returned from Babylon after the exile. There was a substantial Jewish presence who remained. they continued in their Judaism to some extent, various extents, and produced writings which have been transferred. So there must have been a significant Jewish influence. And it's maybe mm-hmm. not so surprising that wise men came expecting something in Jerusalem. Yeah. It's a possibility.
Yeah. Well, we think that the majority of Jews stayed in Jerusalem and only a minority came back to Jerusalem. Majority stayed in Babylon and a minority came back to Jerusalem. So, yeah, there would have been a big group. And that's probably where also the Greek translations of the Old Testament started.
When you were talking last night about the prophecies and the text in the Old Testament about Messiah, I'm not sure you mentioned, I may have had a slight aberration at the time, but I don't remember you mentioning Isaiah 53, which we've always used as the great...
suffering servant?
Yes.
Is that the one?
Yeah.
Yes.
Dying well, for us and taking our iniquity and all the rest of it.
Yeah, we take that one often, but if you read the text as it stands... It doesn't seem to be messianic as such. It seems to be that it's speaking about something occurring then and the Messiah. In the same way as that text about the virgin becoming pregnant, or the young woman becoming pregnant, as the Old Testament would say, that seems to be talking about a current king, but also applies to the Messiah. And the same with the suffering servant. That seems to be talking about current or soon following events, not Messiah as such. And the early Christians took Jesus' ministry and specifically Jesus' suffering and death, and they saw that that can be understood by looking back at Isaiah. But it doesn't seem that Isaiah would have made sense without first seeing Jesus like that. That back then they wouldn't have read that and thought, oh, there's a Messiah coming who's suffering. That doesn't seem to be what's going on there. There's a couple more of those that we due to time, I didn't go into detail with all of them. Like the young woman becoming pregnant, we didn't read that one either. And Isaiah 11, I don't think I read either. And a lot of bits of Ezekiel.
I was interested in what you said about Galilee up there, where it was more maybe historically Assyria had an influence there. Where does that fit in with the 10 tribes who were virtually annihilated after the days of Solomon? Is there any indication that they still were got any of, shall I unquote, God's people still around, or had they been completely assimilated by the other parts of northern areas?
Yeah, what seems to have happened is that after the kingdom fell, many of them were taken away, and the ones that stayed quickly became assimilated with the Persians that stayed, with the Syrians that lived there, and later with the Greeks that moved in. So you had this huge melting pot of various cultures, but it wasn't Jewish, or they became kind of a... They disappeared, not because they were raptured, but because they just became part of the people around them. They didn't have a critical mass to survive. Mike has another.
Only if nobody else has a question.
I don't see many at the moment, so...
If I may, I'd like to pick your brains about Enoch, the Book of Enoch.
Right.
Now, you've mentioned one set of messianic hints, suggestions, references. Now, I recently read through it, just skimmed through it very, very quickly, and there are some chapters which talk about what we would understand as messianic terms, and this will probably ring a bell with you, things like the elect one, the chosen one. I haven't got the text immediately in front of me, but there's the elect one of righteousness. This is in a different chapter. I don't know the dating of it. It may or may not be relevant to the time. But, you know, within the Book of Enoch, and it would be very easy to jump to the conclusion that whoever wrote this has got some sort of messianic figure, and this is all apocalyptic language. But my question is, based on this and what you said a few minutes ago, how much notice can we actually take of the Book of Enoch? Now, it's not part of the Protestant canon, it's part of the pseudepigrapha, so it is under consideration, but how seriously should we take it?
Right. Bit off topic, but let's go for it. The Book of Enoch is probably one of the most famous books that are outside of the Bible, because in a number of Christian churches, it's actually part of the Old Testament. If you go to the Coptic Church, it's in there. If you go to many churches that traditionally come from Africa, so not our churches who've gone there with missionaries, but the actual, there were always Christian churches there, they often take Enoch as part of their canon. So it's, for many people, they consider it inspired writing. The Protestants, the Catholics, the Greek Orthodox, the Russian Orthodox do not. So it's very specific. Enoch is quite famous because in Jude, a book that we generally don't preach a whole lot about, in Jude actually quotes the Book of Enoch word for word, and he says, "Enoch, the eighth of Abraham, said la di da di da," and he quotes word for word as a pastor would quote the book in a sermon, or Matthew would quote Isaiah. So the book was known by Jude. We know that for a fact because he quoted it. And we know that the book has authority for quite a number of Christians. We also know that it's not part of our canon, and we strongly believe that the Lord led the creation of the selection of these 66 books. So first, be clear, it doesn't belong in my red book. Clearly not. But it is a book that we know early Christians did read, because Jude read it, and apparently found some things that they thought were interesting enough into it to put into their letters. That's what we know. What does that mean? Well, it means that probably we should keep a good eye on it because it'll probably help us understand some things better, and it definitely helps us understand the book of Jude better, because then we can read the context of his quote and understand what on earth he's talking about, because Jude is not an easy book to read. That's about as far as I would go without going into a huge discussion about the formation of the canon.
Just as a follow-up question, I mean, please feel free to say, let's talk about it later. How much notice do you think people, the educated classes of the Jews around 1st century BC, 1st century AD, actually took of those writings?
It's always very, very hard to say. The only way we know if someone liked a book is if he writes down, oh, I really like this book, or if he quotes from it. It seems like Enoch was probably one of the more popular ones, because it has more quotes than other ones. It's not as popular as the books that we have in the Apocrypha, the deuterocanonical books, you know, the ones that are often included in Catholic Bibles, but not in Protestant ones. But it's quite well known, which means if it's quite well known, that probably the ideas that are contained in there would have been known to people like Paul and Peter, which means that it could help us understand some of their thinking sometimes, and sometimes it can't. That's, you know, if you want to understand English literature, it's good if you know some Shakespeare, because it helps you understand contemporary writings as well. That's probably how far we should go with that. It helps us understand some common thoughts and sayings.
You have mentioned that the Jews were not much in existence in Galilee.
Mm-hmm.
So when Jesus came, he did a lot of preaching in Galilee, so he would be preaching to the Gentiles as well as the Jews in that case, would he?
Well, we'll talk about Galilee tomorrow morning.
Right.
Right, because tomorrow morning I'm going to start off with the birth of Jesus and the history of Jesus and his social environment, and specifically where his ministry started, and most of his ministry took place in Galilee. He only got down to Jerusalem quite close to the end, or went up a couple of times, but he stayed in Galilee a lot. So there's some things going on there. Mm-hmm. But I can give you the 3-minute version, but tomorrow we get the whole version, and then makes tomorrow a bit boring. So you're just going to have to come tomorrow morning.
And you just...